and almost 8% of the self-employed had earnings below the poverty line in 2020, up 3 percentage points compared to 2010. Italy is one of the few European countries without a minimum wage. A boom in temporary and on-call contracts in recent years and fragmentation in union representation have led to an increase in badly paid, undignifying jobs. Max Civili, Rome.
Israel and Saudi Arabia have no diplomatic relations, officially. But for years, extensive behind-the-scenes diplomatic and intelligence cooperation between Tel Aviv and Riyadh has been open secret. Now, it seems that curtains are falling off of the covert relationship. Israeli media have revealed that an Israeli aircraft landed in an airport in Saudi Arabia's capital, Riyadh, late on Monday. The private plane reportedly took off from Tel Aviv. But this is not the first time that this has happened. Last October, another Israeli private jet landed in Riyadh, making it the first time a public flight from Israel has ever landed in a kingdom. This is the latest among improving regional ties for Israel after agreements to normalize ties with four nations, namely the UAE, Bahrain, Morocco and Sudan, were reached in the 2020 Abraham Accords. Tel Aviv and Riyadh opened their airspaces to each other in 2020. Apart from that, Israeli and Saudi officials have recently openly talked about normalizing ties. Last month, Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman said Riyadh does not look at Israel as an enemy. He went on to describe Israel as a potential ally with many common interests. Saudi Foreign Minister Faisal bin Farhan al-Saud has also recently told a Hebrew language newspaper that the integration of Israel in the region will be a huge benefit not only for Israel, but for the entire region. Israeli President Isaac Herzog on Monday said in an interview that he likes to visit Saudi Arabia openly and called on Riyadh to join the Abraham Accords and normalize its ties with the regime. In November 2020, it was reported that the then Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had secretly visited Saudi Arabia. The warming up of ties comes amid the escalation of tensions in the occupied territories. Israel has increased its raids on Al-Aqsa Mosque in recent weeks and attacks Palestinian towns and cities almost every day. Palestinians have increased their operations in response to the crackdown. They have conducted several stabbing and shooting operations, including one in Tel Aviv in the past 2 months, leaving over a dozen Israelis dead. Palestinian response to the previous normalization deals has been clear, that it has not helped the resolution of the long-standing conflict in any meaningful way, and that Israeli brutalities, killings, house demolitions, land grabs and desecration of their sanctities have continued regardless. To them, resistance remains the only path leading to the liberation of the occupied territories.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight. Two former police officers in Lawton, Oklahoma, United States, were charged with first-degree manslaughter on Friday, 6th of May, in the shooting of a black man in December. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Sophie Kasakov. The piece is titled, Two Former Police Officers Charged in Fatal Shooting of Black Man. Two former police officers in Lawton, Oklahoma, were charged with first-degree manslaughter on Friday, 6th of May, in the shooting of a black man in December. In video footage released by the city of Lawton, Oklahoma, on Friday, the man, Quadri Sanders, appeared to be complying with orders to put his hands up after he was initially shot, when he was repeatedly shot again. The graphic body camera video of the confrontation shows the police officers, Nathan Ronan and Robert Hinkle, responding to a 911 call on 5th of December 2021, just after 8:30 p.m., about a man who was under a protective order entering the home of the person named in the order. Lee Merritt, the family's lawyer, said in a statement that Mr. Sanders had a dispute with a woman when the police were called. Quadri Sanders, a 29-year-old, was the person in violation of the protective order, according to a statement issued in December by the Lawton Police Chief, James T. Smith. The statement added that the caller reported that Mr. Sanders was waving a gun inside the house. Police officers learned that Mr. Sanders was refusing to let one of the residents leave, according to a statement by the district attorney that was reported by the local news station KSWO. The video footage shows police officers using a loudspeaker to alert Mr. Sanders of their presence. A woman exits the home. Mr. Sanders then emerges from a back door, according to a captioned text in the video. Quadri Sanders complied with a police officer's commands to show his hands, according to the district attorney's office, before running back inside the house. When Mr. Sanders exits the house again, the police officer wearing the body camera moves towards him, directing him to put his hands up and get down on the ground. It was not immediately known whether the footage released by the city came from police officer Ronan's body camera or police officer Hinkle's. The only object visible in his hands is a baseball cap, according to the district attorney's statement. Mr. Sanders appears to try to move behind the refrigerator sitting outside. Just as he raised his hands above his head, one of the police officers shoots at Mr. Sanders four times. Quadri Sanders then falls to the ground, at which time a police officer once again says, "Hands, hands, hands." The video footage then shows Mr. Sanders sitting up with his hands above his head, at which point he is shot repeatedly. According to the statement by the district attorney's office, 15 rounds were fired at Quadri Sanders overall, 11 rounds by police officer Hinkle, and four rounds by police officer Ronan. Police officers shout at Quadri Sanders to stay down and roll over on your stomach. Mr. Sanders, writhing in pain, appears to say, "I'm down and I can't breathe." The police officers are then seen dragging Mr. Sanders' limp body from the doorway, leaving a trail of blood on the driveway. They do not begin to treat his wounds for over 2 minutes after firing the final shots. Quadri Sanders was taken to a hospital where he was pronounced dead, according to the statement from the police chief. "I can't find a single redeemable factor that mitigates any suspect of this shooting," Mr. Merritt wrote on Instagram. "It was just murder. There was no justification. These men must be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. Mr. Ronan and Mr. Hinkle were fired from the police department on 7th of January after an internal investigation, which found that the police officers' actions were not in conformance with the Lawton Police Department's well-established training protocols, policies, practices, customs or procedures, according to a statement from the city manager, Michael Cleghorn, in January. A separate criminal investigation was conducted by the Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation, leading the Comanche County District Attorney, Kyle Kabelka, to issue charges on Friday. The former police officers each posted bail at $25,000 on Friday. A hearing is set for 1st of August. According to Oklahoma State sentencing guidelines, penalties for first-degree manslaughter include a minimum sentence of 4 years in prison. Mr. Ronan was previously under investigation for the fatal shooting of another black man, Zontarius Johnson, a 24-year-old, in January of 2021. That shooting occurred just 3 miles from where Quadri Sanders was shot in Lawton, Oklahoma, a city of 90,000, a little over an hour southwest of Oklahoma City. The district attorney's office cleared police officer Ronan of any wrongdoing in April of 2021 after an Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation report which found that Mr. Johnson had raised his gun despite police officer Ronan's command to drop the weapon. Officer Ronan had pursued Mr. Johnson after he heard shots fired outside a local restaurant and saw Mr. Johnson standing in the street with his arm extended, and another person shooting at Mr. Johnson, according to a statement from the police chief. The Lawton Police Department District Attorney Kabelka and Police Officer Hinkle could not be reached for comment. Police Officer Ronan declined to comment. Although this decision and the releasing of information that followed may provide clarity to this tragic incident, it does not come without impacting one's stages of grief and mourning of a lost loved one, Stan Booker, the mayor of Lawton, Oklahoma, said in a statement. Stan Booker added, "I believe the Lawton Police Department holds itself to the highest possible standards, and I know it will continue to do so moving forward."
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
When it comes to the developments in Ukraine, one topic overpowers all of the rest, and that is military assistance. From the U.S., who is leading in arms and weapons assistance, benefiting the U.S. arms manufacturers, to NATO member countries. Brings about the question, is the U.S. pressuring these countries to follow its anti-Russia policies? While at the same time, some EU countries, while voicing their all-out support for anti-Russian sanctions, continue to buy Russian oil, and in particular, gas. This edition of The Spotlight will be focusing on those issues. But first, let me introduce our guests. Anti-war activist Cindy Sheehan joins us from Sacramento, California. Also joining us, writer and political analyst Gerard O'Coleman joins us from Cork, Ireland.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Yeah, I'd like to welcome to you both. And Cindy Sheehan, let me first start with you, if I may. And out of the things that are pretty much dominant these days when it comes to the military operation or war in Ukraine, are the military cells. I mean, we just keep hearing about military cells, left, right, and center seems to be the focus. The latest, the U.S. President Joe Biden, which stood out in terms of the highlight, if you want to call it, this Lockheed Martin company facility in Alabama, and then thanking the workers there and keeping up with the orders. Why is the U.S. is not obviously keeping that behind closed doors anymore. It's out for that. What is your impression of the U.S. intention here?
Well, I mean, the U.S. intention against Russia and Putin has been evident for many years, but especially since 2014 when the U.S. and its State Department envoy Victoria Nuland in 2014 supported the neo-Nazi takeover of the Ukrainian government and the evident Russia-gating, saying that Putin was responsible or Russia was responsible for Trump, that has turned out to be an absolute lie. And the one thing that we've noticed here in the United States, I never needed it to be evident, is that the one thing that the United States still manufactures is weapons, and it's the leading arms dealer around the world. And it's sending billions of dollars in military aid to Ukraine, which of course is a U.S. proxy war against Russia, just like the in the 70s with President Jimmy Carter and Brezhnev. That was a proxy war in Afghanistan against the USSR. And so to talk about how much money the arms industry is getting, the military industrial complex in the United States, is of course a terrible thing when we're here paying so much money for gas and groceries, and there's hyperinflation just coming out of the lockdown. Our economy is getting worse and worse, and it's still the case of a few profiting and a lot of people in misery. And the bad thing is the Ukrainian people are caught in the middle of this. And, you know, the U.S. Political class, the military-industrial complex, plus its supporters in the grassroots are willing to let this go to the last Ukrainian sacrifice. And that's the sad thing about it. And I'm sitting here. I have, you know, children and grandchildren and a community that I love, and the whole world could be affected by World War III. And this continuous push to arm Ukraine and to demonize Russia is not going to end well for anybody unless people step in and say, we need a negotiated ceasefire right now, and then talk about the terms of that so it doesn't escalate further into something worse than it is right now.
Well, unfortunately, if you have the weapons flowing, it's just going to continue, Jacques Coleman.
Absolutely, that's right.
Jacques Coleman, that's the logic behind weapons. They keep flowing, war will continue. And what was very shocking, in a sense, is what this Lockheed Martin Raytheon spokesperson actually said. These two military manufacturers actually make the weapons that many of these countries that I'm about to ask your reaction to, And this spokesperson said, we are exploring options to more quickly replenish U.S. inventories and backfill depleted stocks of allies and partners. One thing that many people don't realize is that the military equipment that NATO member countries actually purchase are from the U.S. So, and here we have the NATO countries, in this particular case, Lockheed and Raytheon spokesperson saying that, you know, we can't fill up the orders as they're coming through. How big a drive is military sales in this conflict?
Well, certainly the goal of the U.S. geopolitically is to divide to separate the European peninsula from the Eurasian landmass. And the key point, the key pivotal point there is Ukraine, because that's the separation point where they can basically separate the Eurasian landmass, Russia and China, from Europe, which is essentially a peninsula. Now, of course, there's a question about where Europe starts and ends. The Russians see Europe as going from Lisbon to Vladivostok. But the Americans want the European peninsula to be a client state, so a unified client state of the United States. And this has always been the policy. So they need to stop Russian oil going into Germany and fueling a German industry. The arms sales, of course, is how you basically make this work. I mean, the U.S. has been putting military bases all around Russia and China for many years, and they need to maintain the global military. This is the new Roman Empire, and of course, like the Roman Empire, it's falling, it's crumbling, and it's taking everybody with it. So right now in Europe, we're all paying the price for this crazy policy. It's become almost obligatory to support Zelensky. It's almost obligatory to be pro-Ukraine. They have Ukrainian flags virtually everywhere in Europe now, in schools. Everybody's going around with Ukrainian flags. So we've been subject to a major brainwashing campaign in the media to demonize Russia and to eulogize Ukraine, of course, ignoring the presence of neo-Nazi shock troops in Ukraine, atrocities being committed on a daily basis. And of course, they have been committed for many years now, since 2014. I mean, I could mention some of them, such as the burning people alive in Odessa in 2014, one of the worst massacres possibly since the Second World War anywhere in Europe, completely ignored by the Western media. So these are the kind of people, you know, the arms are going to. This is what this industry, the military industrial complex, is funding. And the British are very involved, of course, and the French. So these are the key allies of the United States, and perhaps more than allies, puppet states at this stage of U.S. foreign policy. And so the U.S. simply wants to continue that Mackinder-inspired policy of dividing the Eurasian landmass. And the key point there is Ukraine, because it is that point which, from the North Sea to the Black Sea, where the United States can basically militarize that zone and then create a sort of an intermarium where Russia is blocked from Europe. Of course, the consequence of that is that we're paying higher fuel costs. We're paying everything is going up. So, you know, what it will do essentially to the ordinary worker in Europe is bankrupt him. Middle class and working class people will be bankrupt. Businesses will go bankrupt because they cannot keep up with the prices. We have a situation in Ireland, for example, where farmers now have to get loans to get fertilizer. So sooner or later, this is going to crack. The question is when. But, you know, it will also lead to a food crisis, I think, because food prices are already going up. Germany's already experiencing a food crisis.
Yeah, we're going to get into that in a bit in terms of the...
And, the damage is going to be enormous.
Sure. Well, let's try to get a clearer picture over here as to what's really happening, Cindy Sheehan. I mean, when we talk about the fact that you have NATO member countries and European countries in particular coming out condemning Russia, some analysts are saying that that's due to U.S. pressure. Now, how is the U.S. pressuring these countries? Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but... the U.S., through Zelensky now, because I recall distinctly that Zelensky said that other European countries could become a target. And that's the line, one of the lines that the U.S. is pushing in order to get them to cooperate and move ahead with sanctions, move ahead with military assistance, because there's a void not only in their own security apparatus through their armies or what have you, but their reliance, because they're a NATO member of the alliance as a whole. Is that a correct way of depicting this?
Yeah, the U.S. is very famous for using the stick threats, but also the carrot, the promise of, you know, contracts, oil contracts, money, aid. Most of the aid that the U.S. gives, as you mentioned, is military aid. So it's like we're giving money to countries that are going to come right back to the defense contractor. So it's almost like a welfare for the defense contractors to send this aid to NATO and NATO countries that comes back to them to fill their coffers. And so there's always the stick and the carrot in U.S. foreign policy, but it seems like the carrots are also, you know, not very healthy, not very, very positive things. And, you know, I agree with the other guest here in the United States, the fear propaganda is out of control with Putin is another Hitler, and he's going to not stop in the Ukraine. What we saw and what we've been watching very closely since 2014 is that Russia has, with Putin at the head, has shown an extreme amount of restraint in dealing with this Ukrainian issue. Your other guests mentioned the burning of the Union Hall in Odessa, but since 2014, the neo-Nazi sympathizers in the Ukrainian military have been killing people in Lugansk and Donetsk in the Donbass region, so between 14 and 20,000. And I just wonder what the U.S. would do if Mexico killed 20,000 Mexico, the country, the government of Mexico, killed 20,000 U.S. citizens, like in Baja California. Would the U.S. wait 8 years for a military response? And, you know, I doubt it. So Russia, like your other guest said, is feeling surrounded by the U.S. and NATO countries. And I'm just wondering what their response should have been, and what other countries would have done in that same circumstance.
It seems like the rhetoric coming from the U.S. in particular, leading the pack, and then, of course, member countries, but in particular the U.S., Gerard Coleman, is very harsh, and it's almost like taunting and provoking Russia in new ways. For example, very interesting that you have a headline reading, U.S. intelligence is helping Ukraine kill Russian generals. And then you have the details come out that this may have led to 12 Russian generals to be killed, which was a target on that ship to be one of them. And then you have Biden saying, you know, these types of leaks should not come out from U.S. officials. It's almost as if he's mocking the fact that this happened. Not mocking, but by saying that, it's provoking Russia. Also, other news where U.S. is training Ukrainian troops in Germany, and that may be going on in other parts of Europe, of which John Kirby said we can't disclose those locations yet. Is the U.S. trying to elevate this war to another level?
They've been provoking Russia since way before 2014. I mean, it erupted in 2014 with the coup. But since then, they've been hoping for this war. It's not that they don't want the war. Russia doesn't want the war. Russia never wanted the war. It never wanted the coup in Ukraine. It never wanted the entire crisis. This is a pain this is a major crisis for Russia itself, and it doesn't need this crisis. Russia has enough problems to be dealing with. Look, they've been provoking wars on the periphery of Russia for a long time, with color revolutions all over Eastern Europe, Georgia, recently in Kazakhstan. And so they're destabilizing the entire periphery of Russia, Eastern Europe, right into Central Asia. And the aim of this is to provoke world war, essentially. Now, we're in a situation of world war. If you're at war with Russia, and we are at war with Russia, It's a world war, because of course it will involve all of Russia's allies, China, Iran. Everyone will be drawn into this because of the global repercussions. And we're in, I would say, the phony war phase of a world war. In other words, it's sanctions, economic crisis, percolating crisis, destabilization, escalation, and so on. We haven't yet gone into full-scale war where the Russians are retaliating. Of course, the West are actually prepared to provoke Russia into full-scale retaliation. We have people like Nancy Pelosi in the United States saying that it's okay if we go to full-scale nuclear war with Russia. Of course, that means that nuclear missiles will fall Americans, so she doesn't seem to be too bothered by that. Prepared to go for a full-scale with Russia. That will end very badly, and possibly for the United States, but it will certainly wipe out several cities in Europe should the Russians be forced to retaliate. Now, I doubt very much that the Russians will hit Europe first. I think that if Russia is hit, if Moscow is hit, if they cross the border into Russia and start targeting Russian cities, then Russia, of course, will retaliate and European cities will be hit. And, you know, this is where we're at now. And this is a world war. It's the first. We're in the preliminary stages of a world war. Russia hasn't crossed the border yet. But I could see this, you know, escalating. And they certainly want it. This is the problem here. They're not talking about negotiation. They're not talking about reestablishing the Minsk Accords. The door is always open. The Russians have had a very intelligent foreign policy in this regard, because Alexander Lukashenko in Belarus has kind of played the role of intermediary, and it has worked well for Russia, but also for anyone who actually wants to negotiate with Russia. So the door is open for negotiation, but the West doesn't want negotiation. They want full-scale war. It seems that they're prepared to go as far as nuclear war, which, of course, is a situation of mutual annihilation. But, you know, we're living in very disturbing times, and we're ruled by insane elites. I mean, there's no other way to describe it. These people are mentally insane. Biden is mentally insane. Pelosi is insane. So this is the scary thing. You know, right now in Europe, there is, of course, a major division between the hardcore belligerents and those who are more inclined to favorable diplomacy with Russia, such right. as Hungary, Czech Republic, Serbia, and so on. And of course, that is a major weakness. I think a lot of people want to get out of this. They see that there's no point in pushing Russia any further.
Sure. Well, I mean, when we want to take a look at the intentions that the sanctions had, Cindy Sheehan, the ruble has actually recouped most of its losses, based on the report that I read. Mm-hmm. It's become the top-performing currency globally, and it continues mm-hmm. to gain. And it's up 60%, looking at its performance for the month of March. If you want to take a look at the Russian gas deliveries via Ukraine, it's hit a five-month high, and there are 10 European countries that are quietly buying Russian gas, even though the EU has come out and said that, you know, it's banned. I mean, you know, you can't buy Russian gas. Mm-hmm. So the intended results they don't have that maximum impact when it comes to sanctions. But right. what is having an impact is the material or the information that you gave us, Cindy Sheehan, from your part of the world in Sacramento, of which you're looking at high prices, inflation, stagflation, maybe. The U.S. may be heading towards a recession. 1.2% contraction was recorded. You have things mm-hmm. Like what's happening in Europe with energy costs and people who are obviously suffering. And it's really sad to see. It's mostly really the poor who are suffering mm-hmm. the most out of this. And the list goes on and on. Is the world suffering because of what is happening based on the U.S. leading the pack into this?
I think that this is like the culmination of U.S. foreign policy, especially since 9/11, 2001. And I see that, yes, people here in the United States are suffering economically, and they're not putting together that the sanctions and the reliance on this destructive military-industrial complex industry is harming everybody from, you know, babies to old people. And so they're not putting two and two together. They've been told, as your other guest said, that nuclear war is winnable and survivable. And so there's a situation in the grassroots where half of the people that align with the Democratic Party are believing this. And then we have the people on the right who have always been pretty war hungry, and they're couching their propaganda in terms of being, you know, that this is a humanitarian crisis in Ukraine. And I know this is getting a little bit off the topic, but my energy always goes around what's happening to the people on the ground. So people are really sad, you know, here in the United States for what's happening in Ukraine, not even taking a look or hearing about the U.S., Saudi Arabia, Israel, you know, war against the people of Yemen, and that actual humanitarian crisis there, where, you know, hundreds of thousands of people have died from sanctions and bombing and, you know, things like that. So the military-industrial complex here, mostly in the United States, I say global imperialism led by U.S. imperialism, we do have a psychotic foreign policy. We have a psychotic government. We have a president who doesn't even know where he is half the time, who has his finger could be on the button of nuclear annihilation, which doesn't give me any, you know, confidence. And so this is a bad situation. Okay. Where we're having all kinds of this patriotism here in the United States, but the patriotism is by flying Ukrainian flags. And so it is a very scary situation.
All right. Unfortunately, we've ran out of time. Thank you so much for that, Cindy Sheehan, anti-war activist from Sacramento, California. Wish we had more time. Again, Joel Holdman, thank you for your input, writer and political analyst. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikko Itagüe and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
A heartland slump and hundreds of seat losses in UK's local elections will put new pressure on Prime Minister Boris Johnson. But his opponent, Labour's Keir Starmer, may also face criticism after failing to deliver a knockout. We now present you an article written by Robert Ford, Professor of Political Science at University of Manchester and author of The British General Election of 2019. The piece is titled UK Local Election Results Were Messy. Now Boris Johnson's future is on the line. The UK's Conservatives lost, but Labour didn't win. In a messy night with multiple cross-currents, voters turned against the Tories in many areas. Yet an uneven Labour performance failed to fully dispel doubts about its appeal to the British electorate. Conservative nerves will be jangling after a heartland slump and the loss of prized London councils. But Labour strategists will also be anxious about mediocre performances in the Leave-leaning battlegrounds of England. It was the Liberal Democrats who had the happiest night on Thursday, 5th of May, posting hundreds of gains up and down the country, while the Greens made major gains as voters sought alternatives to an unpopular government and an unconvincing opposition. A heartland slump and hundreds of seat losses will put new pressure on Prime Minister Boris Johnson. But his opponent, Labour's Keir Starmer, may also face criticism after failing to deliver a knockout punch. This was on any measure a bad night for the Conservatives, who won 30% on the BBC's projected national share calculation, which adjusts for variations in the areas up for election in each local election cycle. This was down 4 percentage points on 2018, when the seats up this week were last contested, and 6 percentage points on 2021. The Tory poll slump has been matched at the ballot box, with nearly 350 English council seats lost, almost a quarter of the party's starting total. Labour's projected 35% was up 4 percentage points on last year and gave the opposition the largest lead over the government since 2012. There was plenty for the party to cheer about as the opposition gained seats and took control of councils across all three British nations. But Labour's overall vote share was no better than 4 years ago, and the party's progress was uneven. Advance in Scotland and Wales was easier as seats in both countries were last up in 2017, giving Labour a lower starting point. Labour made some dramatic breakthroughs in London and an overall gain in the south of England, but its vote share stagnated in the Midlands and fell back in the north, suffering overall net seat losses across both crucial battleground regions. The Liberal Democrats won a huge haul of more than 200 net seat gains, beating all expectations as disgruntled voters in Tory heartlands swung to the party across England, with gains in Scotland and Wales as well. The Greens were also smiling after a third strong showing in a row in local elections, up by an average of 4 percentage points on 2018 in seats they contested both times, with concentrated surges helping them to capture more than 60 English seats, often on huge swings. While the local results will be sifted for portents of progress or decline in the next general election, The election with the most immediate political consequences was in Northern Ireland, where Sinn Féin made political history by becoming the first nationalist party ever to top the poll in the province. Yet this, too, was a messy result, defying simple interpretation. Sinn Féin did not win new support, it simply held its vote together, while the unionist vote disintegrated, with a large swing away from the DUP to the anti-Northern Ireland protocol TUV. And in an election with potentially seismic consequences for the balance of power between unionists and nationalists, the biggest gains were made by the Alliance, a party that rejects sectarian politics altogether. Change is in the air in Northern Ireland, though what form that change will take remains unclear. London grabbed the early headlines on Friday, 6th of May, as the Conservatives suffered a meltdown in the capital, with a dismal result exceeding the most pessimistic pre-election predictions. Losing three high-profile councils with only the unexpected gain of Harrow to brighten an otherwise dark night. The Labour Party had not run any of Barnet, Wandsworth or Westminster for nearly 50 years. Now they control all three. The red tide has been rising in the capital for many years, and with Labour now in control of Margaret Thatcher's favourite council and the seat of government itself, the capital is close to becoming a one-party state. Yet while this was a worst-case scenario for the Conservatives, the underlying trends driving their decline are not new. All the pro-Labour currents in today's politics converge in London, which is younger, more ethnically diverse, more graduate-heavy, and more on the Remain side than the nation as a whole. While a Conservative decline in London was expected, a collapse for the government in its heartlands was not. The Tories are now suffering a major bout of southern discomfort. The fall in Tory support was much larger in the southeast of England than in the north or Midlands, and largest of all, in the southern bastions where they performed best in 2018. Tory decline in the home counties, already evident in the 2019 general election, has intensified. Southern Tory MPs will be getting nervous as double-digit swings to the Liberal Democrats suggest even those with large majorities may not be safe from a revolt of disgruntled middle-class professionals. The anxiety will intensify if the forthcoming Tiverton by-election brings defeat in another heartland seat that has hitherto returned Tory MPs for a century. After 5 years as the punchbag of coalition and four as the tribunes of Remain, the Liberal Democrats are recovering their traditional role as the catch-all party of protest. The third party bested the Conservatives up and down the country, from David Cameron's West Oxfordshire to Tim Farron's Westmoreland and Furness. Liberal Democrat activists will be particularly heartened by a strong recovery in Somerset, a Leave-leaning former heartland area where their vote had been decimated by coalition and Brexit. The party will hope Thursday's sweeping gains, which delivered control of the newly created council, will be a harbinger of recovery in its erstwhile heartlands of the southwest. This was another strong election cycle for the Greens, whose advance in local elections is posing new questions for all political parties. The Greens now provide a new challenge for Labour in many urban strongholds and for the Conservatives in Remain-leaning bits of their heartlands. The Liberal Democrats face competition for protest votes in graduate-heavy places, while in Scotland, the Greens are challenging the Scottish Nationalist Party, the SNP, for pro-independence voters. Three big seat halls in a row mean the Greens are now an established presence on councils across Britain, though it remains to be seen whether they can use a growing local presence as a springboard to credible general election campaigns. Beneath the headlines is a complicated set of results that defy simple interpretation. The opposition had bounced back strongly on their 2021 lows and done best in the most pro-Leave areas of England. A messy result will do little to resolve internal party debates, as each side will pick the data to suit their story. For example, supporters of Keir Starmer will point to big swings since last year as evidence that Labour is recovering from a historic collapse in 2019. Keir Starmer's critics will say stagnant support and seat losses show that Starmer's approach is not delivering results, even against a floundering government in crisis. Both sides have a point. Labour are recovering, but have a lot of work still to do. Neither will these results provide resolution to the Conservative debate over Boris Johnson's leadership. Hundreds of seat losses and a heartland collapse will hand potent ammunition to Boris Johnson's opponents. Yet loyalists will point to a relatively strong showing in the English battlegrounds, as evidence that this hold on Leave voters' affections remains intact. Keeping Boris Johnson could add fuel to a southern heartland revolt, but replacing him with a central casting Conservative could trigger a red wall backlash. The Prime Minister's fate may turn on which of these risks worries his MPs most.